Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We'll hear a discussion about the life and music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, which followed a screening of the director's cut of the 1984 film Amadeus, directed by Milos Forman. The members of the panel included Omaha Symphony Music Director Thomas Wilkins, Professor of Music at the University of Nebraska at Omaha James Johnson, and Professor of Music from Creighton University Carol Seitz. This event took place in conjunction with a concert by the Omaha Symphony Chamber Orchestra featuring the music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The film, starring Tom Hulce as Mozart and F. Murray Abraham as Salieri, and told in flashback, portrays the conflict between established Italian composer Antonio Salieri and the young Austrian upstart Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in trying to maintain the favor of Austrian Emperor Joseph II and achieve the post of court composer. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 24, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Omaha Symphony Music Director Thomas Wilkins.
We'd like to make this as much of a discussion as possible, by the way. So surely if you have comments about what you just saw or questions, we will be happy to answer those or even make up answers. With me is from Creighton is Professor Carol Seitz, and from UNO, Dr. James Johnson. So we're delighted that you could join us.
Thank you.
You know, I couldn't help but think as I saw that last scene, that was 1791, and there was Mozart's body lying in a pauper's grave. And meanwhile, in that same town, Haydn, Franz Josef Haydn, was at the height of his fame. And also in November of that year, there was a young 22-year-old pianist slash composer headed to Vienna by the name of Ludwig van Beethoven. So for me, the juxtaposition of seeing that image and knowing that there are these two other giants, well, one of them is not a giant yet because he's only 22 years old, that being Beethoven, but that Haydn is there and has a completely different life at this stage of the game from Mozart was quite striking for me. Any impressions from any of you or from the two of you as to what you felt, experienced?
It seems so ironic that that should be true, that because while I think that Haydn is a great composer, I don't place him up there on the level with Mozart. Mm. And in fact, with piano students that I teach, I don't normally let them even play a Mozart sonata until they've played a bunch of Beethoven sonatas and a bunch of Haydn sonatas. Mm-hmm. Then they can do Mozart, because it requires so much more, I think. And then when you look at the way they were treated and the way they were perceived in their own time,
right.
Mm-hmm. It's very...
Well, I had a student who did a paper once on the funerals of that time, and there was a class one, which was reserved for aristocracy, and there was a class two, which Beethoven was buried with a class two funeral, and Mozart was a class three, and it was common. The casket had to sit for 48 hours so that they knew for sure the person was gone. And it was a shaft where, you know, five or six other bodies were buried. So there was this social structure, and even though Mozart was a genius, and we'll probably never see the like of him again, he is buried in an unknown grave.
Yeah. It's you know, one of the things that you sort of alluded to that we don't really sort of get from the film is that they really were, composers were sort of like livery, you know.
Yes.
And they you know, they kept referring to Salieri as your excellency, but he was basically just a hired hand, just like everyone else. Mm-hmm. So that when Mozart wanted to be released from service, that was very early in the film, it wasn't his call to just sort of jump up and quit. In fact, there is one moment in his life which was not reflected in the film, was when Gluck had passed away and Mozart gets his job. Well, Gluck was being paid 2,000 florin for that job, and Mozart was being paid 800. You're right, 800. And he said, "Oh, they're paying me way too much for what I'm doing, and not nearly enough for what I'm capable of doing." I mean, it's so it was a very interesting life for composers and musicians at the time.
Well, Haydn had a very good patron, and he had everything almost that a composer could want to work with. He had a puppet theater, he had a church choir, he had an orchestra, but he had no freedom. If he wanted to travel anywhere, then he had to apply to his prince to allow him to go. And so, in a way, he said that the world came to him because the Prince Esterhazy that he worked for was he had a well-known, established art, and lots of artists liked to come there. So Haydn said the world came to him, and Mozart did not have that advantage. Beethoven, on the other hand, made his own way, and he said, you know, when he didn't tip his hat to a better, he said he should be tipping his hat to me. So he changed the whole patronage system.
Yeah. He also said that he, because he was so isolated out there, that he was completely original.
Right.
That he sort of made the claim that he wasn't influenced by anyone else. Mm-hmm. Though I don't think that can ever be completely true of
this
composer.
Who said this, Beethoven?
Haydn.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Haydn.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the three lives are so intertwined that if one of them had not lived, they would have written differently. Mm-hmm. I think they really influenced each other in a way. I think Mozart learns from Haydn as a young man, but I think Haydn learns from Mozart. I hear things in those later symphonies that, and I know that there are things I hear in Mozart operas that I hear coming back in Beethoven symphonies. Mm-hmm. So I think they all learn from each other.
Certainly. Well, Beethoven, by the way, was en route to Vienna from Bonn to study with Haydn. Mm-hmm. That was his chief purpose for landing in that city. But, you know, it's funny because on this program that's coming up on May 9th at 7 o'clock at the Holland Center, in the Mozart Symphony number 39 that we're doing on that program, you get a sense that he really did pay homage to Haydn's E minor symphony. In fact, there's some allusion to that. And none of them, you're right, would have basically existed without the other. I just did last week in Salt Lake City Beethoven's Fourth Symphony, mm-hmm. which clearly shows that he paid attention to Haydn, who was, and in fact, Haydn was his teacher, but quite frankly, Beethoven learned more from Haydn's scores than he did from Haydn himself.
Haydn wasn't very interested in him.
Not at all.
He just thought he wasn't that great as a piano student. And didn't.
Did Mozart have just one child, and what happened to that one child?
That is so funny. You know, I'm sitting here during the film and thinking, I have no recollection of what happened to that child, or if he had more. I don't guess he had more than one. But as I watched that little boy, I thought, whatever happened to that part of the story? Because no one tells that part of the story.
Well, Constanze remarried, and I haven't read anything recently about the boy.
Well, I don't think the child, he may have become a musician, but he didn't equal his father in terms of his fame and level of genius, apparently.
You know, Mozart was actually in love with Costanza's sister, who broke his heart. Mm-hmm. It's funny that when his wife was introduced, that Costanza was there first, but it was Aloysia,
right?
And he had the major hots for her, and she inspired him, and then she dumped him, and then it turned out okay if it was that actress.
They didn't actually.
Then you know what I'm saying, okay?
They didn't actually make that decision to be married until some time. It was at least a few days after the production of that opera. So that was it didn't happen exactly the way it was in the movie. So,
You talked about Haydn and Beethoven, but Bach was kind of on the scene around that same time too, right?
Well, Bach died in 1750. And so this is, what's
1756 was Mozart's birthday.
And he died so right. in
he
1791.
He was born six right. years after Bach died.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought I had heard sometime that Mozart was inspired by Bach's counterpoint.
Everybody was. Absolutely.
Yes,
yeah. The last movement of the 41st Symphony is a double fugue, and it's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, but that when you talk about people who inspired by Bach, you also have to throw in Miles Davis and a host of other composers. So that makes perfect sense. But it's interesting because with Bach dying in 1750, that sort of signaled the end of that Baroque period. I mean, it sort of became the unofficial ending right. of the Baroque, and it sort of ushers in this new era now with Mozart and Haydn.
Is there historical evidence that Salieri really tried to undermine Mozart's career?
I don't think so.
I think that's as open to question and as mm-hmm. unlikely as it is that he killed. You should answer. You should speak to this.
No,
you know more about it.
No, I don't. the rumors that Salieri murdered him or poisoned him began fairly soon after Mozart died, but I've not read anything that was made that definite.
Yeah, you could suspect that that was poetic license, sort of reading into the mind. As I said earlier, you know, this, you know, Mozart, when Mozart was 3 years old, he would sit and watch his sister Marianne's music lessons. And then one day he climbs up on the bench of the harpsichord. And he starts to just, and he's had no musical training whatsoever. He just starts to plunk out these chords, trying to figure out chords. And it's his father, of course, who is correctly portrayed as being a musician, a very well-known and very talented musician, also a very shrewd musician, notices that what this young three-year-old boy is doing. And he realizes right away that there is this genius here. And so as has been chronicled, and even Salieri, the character Salieri refers to this boy being, you know, taken all over Europe, and you know, he's 4 years old now, and he's dictating inventions to his father to write down because he doesn't know how to write them down, and he's, you know, studying composition at five. He tries to write his first opera at six. In the film, they talk about him being 14 or something by the time, but he tried at 6 years old, for crying out loud. So, and as I the other thing is, as I sort of alluded to in my opening comments, that for him, composition was like breathing. I love the fact that the film caught correctly mm-hmm. that Mozart never bothered with the step of orchestration. He never bothered with the step of figuring out, after he wrote the music, which instrument was going to get which part. As it came from him, the scene, that one of these final scenes was, you know, from his brain, second bassoon, second beat. You know, this was, he already knew which voice it was going to be in. And so you can just imagine with someone, Salieri taught Schubert and Beethoven and Franz Liszt. I mean, it wasn't like this guy was some hack. And just to think that all of a sudden into his sphere comes this Tiger Woods of composers, when he's still trying to perfect his backswing as a composer, this other kid comes along. It would be a safe bet that he would be a little antsy about it. So I would say that even though we have no way to document it, I would guess that he probably was.
When he was dictating music to Salieri, would you understand what he was saying? I'm not a musician. Would you have been able to transcribe that into a...
Well, there have been numerous examples of people who were dying. Well, maybe not numerous, but there have been examples throughout the history of music of composers who were dying who dictated music to someone else who wrote it out for them. J.S. Bach, for instance, dictated his final work, which was a chorale prelude for organ, to his son-in-law, who wrote it out for him. I don't think that when a composer dictates music to someone else, it usually happens quite... It seemed in the movie to be... Well, we sort of looked at each other because it seemed to be happening by osmosis. Sometimes. Right. You know, he just sort of went... Right. And then Salieri would say, oh, yes, I get it.
Right. G-sharp, of course, G-sharp.
I don't think it really happens quite that way.
And we're all thinking back to sophomore theory where you had to do dictation and you're praying to God that the person would slow down so you could write it all again.
It wasn't clear whether Mozart's music was widely accepted or by what audiences it was widely accepted. I was trying to compare him to current modern composers who may have a tough time getting their work heard more than once. Mm-hmm.
That's another can of worms.
Well,
that's a whole another discussion.
I would say... The blessing and the curse of working for the aristocracy is that, as we were talking about Haydn, is that you have there are concerts going on in his domain, for example. So there's a reason for these composers to write because they know their music is going to be heard. And part of the answer to the question that you're asking. Is a dilemma that modern composers face now. You know, they're not going to write for the orchestra if we don't play their music. But you notice that scene when, for example, Magic Flute was being performed. There were the common folk, and it was a very different sort of scene. And a lot of opera was like that. It was that crazy and that entertaining. And by the time we get to sort of the middle of the late part of the 19th century, where we start to lose the aristocracy, and the, you know, rise of the middle class, not the age of enlightenment, but the Industrial Revolution, audiences start to look differently. But still, in those days, composers, and I contend, composers still had. Listen, if Ravel or Berlioz. Or let me say it backwards, the other way. If Mozart had heard the music of Berlioz or heard the music of Ravel, he wouldn't have thought it was strange because we're really talking about one sound world that covers a large period of time. And so my point is that even when you get past Mozart and past sort of ready-made audiences, the Beethoven and the Mendelssohn and the Brahms, they were still working in the same sort of sound world that would make audiences want to hear their music. It was a
system of major and minor tonality,
right.
That people, and it had a syntax and a sort of grammar about it, so that audiences had an expectation that the five chord would resolve to the one chord,
right.
And that certain things were going to happen that the ear would recognize.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point in the early 20th century, that began to break down, and composers were saying, we've gone as far as we can with this. We're going to just do something different.
Mm-hmm.
So Mozart might have been shocked by what happened after Ravel
and
Debussy,
right.
Mm-hmm.
But Debussy especially. But yeah, I think you're right about that.
Has this movie changed where you can take musicians or where you can take audiences when you play Mozart?
I have a feeling that I did not understand Mozart until I was in my 30s. And I play it for my kids in music appreciation, and I don't think they quite get it yet. I'm not sure whether they've lived enough or have experienced enough. I was reading an essay by Aaron Copland on Mozart, and he says you can pore over him, you can dissect him, you can do all this, but you cannot seize him. And when I look at some of the melodies, thinking about a particular aria from The Marriage of Figaro, I don't know why it does what it does. I simply cannot put that into words. And Peter Schaffer does a really, I think, excellent job of putting something that I really can't put into words. He does a pretty good job, particularly that opening scene where Salieri is talking about what he's hearing and mm-hmm. what it does to him.
I think we all might have stories about the effect that this play and later on the movie that we saw tonight has had on the interest in the music of Mozart. I think there's been sort of a resurgence of greater interest since the play was written in the music of Mozart. Well, to give you an example, I had a student some years ago who loved this movie. He had the video of it at home and just watched it over and over again. And so I said to him one day at a lesson, I think that you should learn the Mozart concerto in E flat. And I told him the K number, and he looked it up and he said, that's the one that was in the movie. He was so excited, and you know, had it not been for the movie, he would have just said, "Well, okay, I'll take a look at it." Mm-hmm. You know, and it wouldn't have been. I think he wouldn't have been as excited had he not been introduced to it in this way. Yeah. So it's had an effect, you know, that in countless ways.
I certainly love the notion too of taking artists and composers sort of out of the clouds and into the living room. So that we realize that, you know, sometimes when I talk about why a composer writes what they write, and I said, composers never write to demonstrate their knowledge of music theory. They always write, whether they express it overtly with their words or not, they always write to make some sort of connection to humanity. Mm-hmm. And there's a speech that I give based on built around Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I talk about, you know, it's in C minor, and I talk about why he gives us in the last movement an arpeggio, and then a descending half of a major scale, and then all of a ascending major scale. It's so that, not so that we understand he understands the key, it's so that we get that it's now in the key of C major, and because we have bought into the despair and the agony of the C minor in the first movement, and that, you know, pounding on the door, ja-da-da-da, ja-da-da-da, over. Because we bought into that, because who among us doesn't know struggle and who among us doesn't know obstacle, he wants us to also buy into the triumph at the end. Mm-hmm. So he says to us in the opening few moments of that last movement, get it. I want you to get it because I'm doing this for you, you know. And so to that extent that we could talk about Mozart and talk about him as a human being and then have people who are professionals say words like, yeah, but I can't explain it, but it's just the right note. It's supposed to be that note. I don't know why. I just know that it is. To be able to have those kinds of passionate discussions about this, from a very human level, I think allows people to not be intimidated by it. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, yeah, I felt that. I can't explain it either. And you get paid to not be able to explain it. What's up with that, you know?
You know, I may be wrong in this because I think you can't always know what a composer is thinking when they compose, but I've always believed that great composers write through inspiration. Mm-hmm. And while they might know what they're doing, they're able to tell you, they're able to label every chord in a piece that they write and tell you exactly what all of the harmonic language is. That's not really particularly what they're thinking about when they're thinking about the essence of what it is that they want to say with the music. And then later on, somebody analyzes it.
Right.
Right.
You know,
that's, right.
You know, I have a good friend who's a composer who took a seminar with Aaron Copland, Aaron was coming to his school, and so he took his third symphony or something, and he analyzed the heck out of it, you know. And Copland comes in, and he says, "Mr. Copland, I want you to see this. Look, this is your..." And Copland looks at the thing and says, "I wrote that." You know? I've been crying out loud. That's not what I wrote.
I think one of the best resources that I have read are Mozart's letters. And sure, they're translations, but you get a view of the real person there. He loved to rhyme things. Mm-hmm. And you've got just a little bit of that in the film. But we also make it, the film makes it sound like it's really easy for him. And he says in his letter, you know, "I had to work this out. I work hard on it. It's just that he did it in his head." Beethoven did his in a series of
sketches
and changed it until he got it just like he wanted it. But reading the letters is really, really good.
I don't know if we really answered this completely earlier, but as far as the relationships and his life and how that all worked in the movie, is that pretty accurate? as far as they portrayed it, in his relationships with Salieri and how he worked with the emperor and the other people there?
Yeah, we sort of alluded to that earlier, that some of it, of course, was poetic license to create drama, but he certainly was the relationship that he had with the Archbishop in Salzburg, mm-hmm. that was pretty dead on, mm-hmm. With him. The degree to which he was not respecting mm-hmm. the hierarchy, mm-hmm. I don't know. But as far as the people who hired him was concerned, I think those relationships were certainly clear. I'm not sure about Salieri, to tell you the truth, his relationship with Salieri.
Well, you know, if you were a playwright and you were going to try to flesh out an historical character, whenever you give them dialogue, unless you take it directly from letters that they wrote, mm-hmm. then you raise these questions that really can never be answered, that we really can't know with certainty.
He was critical of other composers in some of his letters, that the ones especially that he wrote to his father. He would say, "I went to a concert and this was played," and so you can see you can hear how he feels about other composers writing during that time, none of whom are really big names that you remember. So,
and the relationship between he and his father, that was pretty well portrayed.
Yes,
he was quite. I mean, his father poured most of his adult life nurturing his son, even. As we saw, even into his son's adult life, so that was pretty dead on.
One of the resources I read said that his father was not well liked, and he never got the job that he wanted, which was the top Kapellmeister. He was always the deputy, and it was because he wasn't liked by his colleagues and et cetera.
One source that I read described Mozart's father as being first his manager and later on his servant. he changed over in those roles as Mozart matured.
When did I get my manager to do that? Convert. Well, listen, the reason that I'm not sitting here alone is because I am not nearly an expert on Mozart, and I needed some major league help. All I do is conduct, and I know what I love, and that's the extent of my knowledge. And so, to have James Johnson here from UNO and Carol Seitz from Creighton has been a great gift to me. So I thank you both very much for being here.
You are our gift.
Hang on one second, because I want her to say this into the mic.
He is a gift to our community.
Okay. Now step away from the mic.
And I would add to that I think you've evinced that you know a lot. You didn't really need us.
Right, I know. Yeah.
Listen, thanks to the folks here. This has been just a great treat to be in this theater. And if I'm saying this now for the benefit of those people who will hear this on the radio, if you have not been down to Film Streams, this is a first-class facility, and it's very comfortable, and you need to get it down here so you can see this place. The fact that we have this in our community is pretty fantastic and tray cool. So come on down. Thank you for being here. Good night.
You've been listening to a discussion about the life and music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, which followed a screening of the director's cut of the 1984 film Amadeus, directed by Milos Forman. The event took place at Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. The panelists were Omaha Symphony Music Director Thomas Wilkins, Professor of Music at the University of Nebraska at Omaha James Johnson, and Professor of Music from Creighton University Carol Seitz. The event took place in conjunction with a concert by the Omaha Symphony Chamber Orchestra featuring the music of Mozart. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 24th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Laura Shainrock, Casey Logan, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams, and Sarah Brownlee of the Omaha Symphony for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.